This is Morgan Michael, welcoming you to Kindsight 101, the podcast, where you'll hear from world-renowned educational leaders about the mobilizing power of kindness, together by challenging our assumptions and venturing beyond the status quo in education. We can make a big impact, one small act at a time.
I do have vague memories of being in a regular grade two classroom and sitting on my own while everybody else sat and read with the teacher because I couldn't read the book that they were reading.
You're going to love my conversation with Delphine Rule if you've ever taught or had a child with learning disabilities. You'll learn some practical adaptations to use at home and school, and the one thing that you need to remember heading into a parent-teacher conference. Delphine Rule is the mother of three children, two of whom have ADHD as well as learning disabilities, and she herself has a learning disability. She has spent the last 14 years working with students with learning challenges, both in and out of the classroom. Parents often have questions that are not always answered. Her goal is to be that support and sounding board for families through Access to Education. You can find out more at accesstoeducation.com. Delphine Rule, it is so great to have you on Kindsight 101. Thank you so much for joining me on the call today.
Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to chat and be involved.
Me too. So I'd like to actually start with your own journey because you are an educator, but you actually have sort of a personal experience with struggling in school, if that's correct. And I understand that when you were going to school, you had your own experience of learning disabilities, and that has, I'm guessing, has really guided the work that you do today and the type of advocacy work that you do. Can you tell me a little bit about your experience and how it influenced your journey into special education and advocacy?
Yeah, so I was diagnosed at about 7 years old, so I would have been in about grade two, with dyslexia, which initially I think many people felt was sort of a, you know, won't be able to accomplish much, and we'll put her in a special education program and continue to support her, but, you know, dreams of sort of university and even the high school that I went to, you know, everybody sort of said, don't set your sights that high.
Right.
But I was very lucky that I had parents who advocated for me in an unbelievable way. But I also had special education teachers in my life who believed in my ability, who were able to find my strengths and build on those. And then when those strengths were really solid, they were then able to bring me to my weaknesses and say, okay, now we need to work on this. And a defining moment for me really was at the end of grade eight, I had to decide where I was going to go to high school. And at that point I had said, you know what, I've learned some great coping mechanisms and you all have supported me in such a way that I'm ready to go on without support. And I essentially was told in that meeting that that was not a good idea and that I should go to a school that had a small class program that I could go into. Huh. And that I shouldn't go to university because college would be a better fit. University would be too difficult. Well, I'm now nearly 40 and have beaten that. I went to university. I got a degree in physical education and kinesiology. And I then went off to teacher's college and really love that I can give back to the special education students and that when they're frustrated, I get it. And I really can say to them, I understand, I'm with you. I know it's hard and we need to work together. But I'm also helping teachers to see that too. So it's a nice side of it. And then also now I have one child for sure who's dyslexic and another child who were just literally started yesterday the process of assessments for him. So I also get it from a parent perspective in terms of, you know, giving space for those parents who are going down a road that is very frightening and can be very long and just, you don't know, unknowns. Nobody likes unknown.
Yes. Oh, so people
that's
do not.
My story.
Yeah. People do not like uncertainty. That's for sure. And wow, what a story. First of all, congratulations. I think obviously your tenacity served you well. And I think this is such an important piece. As an educator, I've come across, of course, within every class, there's always some who, and I teach primary, so it doesn't really, you know, our understanding of their learning and where they're at doesn't really solidify until a little bit later into the later grades. But you can certainly see how difficult learning can be for a small portion of pretty much every class I've ever taught. There's always a couple that really do struggle and that, you know, do have a difficult time. And so I think about that tenacity and how so much of success is based around that idea of self-perception, right? And how much the story that we tell ourselves about the things that we can achieve and the goals that we set for ourselves, so much of that narrative is what helps us to be successful. What do you think about that in terms of your own journey?
It resonates a lot. I definitely had parents who never said no, who said you can't do it, who said, you know, you're dyslexic, so you shouldn't. There were people in my life who would later find out that I was dyslexic and would say, oh, well, that means you read everything backwards and you can't, you know, do things. And I'm thinking, well, I don't read things backwards and I can do lots of things.
Yes.
I just don't do them the way you do them. Mm-hmm. I've never been one to very often say I can't. I am one to say I need to try. And I honestly did that with my son this morning. We were having a bit of a moment today trying to get out the door, day two of school, and he had to do something that he really didn't want to do. And I said to him several times, you need to take the words I can't out of your vocabulary because it's not helpful. If you say you can't, your brain will say, oh, well, I give up. And I think part of the tenacity that I've had is to say, if you're going to tell me I can't do something, I'm going to do it anyway to prove that I can. So I think when I work with my students, I try never to use those terms of you can't, you won't be able to, you're not smart enough, you don't have the ability, you can't, you know. A lot of what I say to them is, let's look for a different way. You know, if doing math in your head doesn't work, can we write it down? Can we use manipulatives? Can we find another way to do it? And I think that as educators, it's hard. We have big classes with lots of diverse kids in our classrooms, mm-hmm. various levels of readiness for any one topic, and being able to always stop and look at each kid and go, okay, well, you need to have this and you need to have that times, you know, 20 or 30, depending on your grade, is hard. But there are certain kids, I think, who, you know, IEPs or not, who need to have differentiated stuff. And it's a very technical term to say that, but very differentiated. And that's what's going to help them see that they can, because we don't all have the same brain, therefore we can't all learn the same way.
I really love that you said, let's just find a different way. I think so often we're trying to put these kids in, you know, their circles, going into these square pegs, and it's not really working. And often the message that they come away with is there's something wrong with me or I'm broken. So in terms of how you've sort of answered the how can parents and teachers support that self-worth, even if a child is struggling in school, what would you say to a student who comes home and says, I feel like I'm falling behind, or there's sort of this awareness that they don't feel as quote unquote smart as the other kids? How would you respond to a child who feels that way?
That's a tough one, because you instantly want to fix it. And this isn't something you can fix. This is something you need to, in my opinion, and I've done it with at least one student I can think of, you need to validate the feeling. They're allowed to not feel comfortable at school. They're allowed to not be happy in the space they're in. But then it becomes, okay, so you're falling behind in, I'm going to use an example, you're falling behind in reading, mm-hmm. and you know that your friends are reading chapter books and you are still reading, you know, the small books. Okay, well, what are some things that I can help you with? How can I help you to catch up? So maybe they can find a solution. And sometimes giving them the power to say, what is it that you need? I find sometimes as parents, we say to your kid, well, you have to sit down and read every day for 30 minutes. But if you're telling them to do that, I don't know about you, but most of the time when I tell my kids to do something, they want to do the exact opposite. So the theory is try and get them to see what works and how do they want to do it. Maybe it's starting to read books online if that's what interests them. There's lots of companies now online doing stories online. And if computers are the thing, or iPads or whatever, the thing that engage them, you know, maybe books that aren't on paper. You need to find the thing that, I always say, it unlocks the key for them to want to learn. Mm. So finding what works for them and what they are driven towards. My middle kid is driven towards anything Beyblade, and that seems to be how we get him to do things. And yes, it sounds crazy, and it sounds like I'm buying into what he wants, but it's really about providing him with the incentive, because he is struggling so much right now.
Yes.
And so it's not really about stifling the fact that he feels that he can't. It's about providing him with the reward, or that feeling of being successful.
Yes.
And, you know, think of anything that you do. If you're not successful at it, you don't want to do it anymore. And that's the thing as parents, you know, we want our kids to be successful all the time. And we just, sometimes we want it so bad that we don't think about how our kid might want that to happen. So really, you know, sit down and have a discussion. Well, what are you falling behind in? How do you think you're falling behind? Why are you different? Why do you think it's different? You know, and chances are, in most classrooms, you know, that one child isn't the only one,
mm-hmm.
but that's the one who notices. That's the one who's more in tune with themselves. And that's the one who's going to notice more than anything.
That's right. And it's so interesting that you talk about that Beyblades thing, because it's really about actually them buying into the program too. And so instead of thinking even of it as us buying into them, it's more about what gives them the buy-in, right? And so, I mean, I had a student recently who we were writing our own version of fairy tales, and he was the same. He loves the Beyblades. And so we did this big battle story, and it had the same story arc as any other story. The characters were Beyblades. And so I think we have to be creative in terms of how we approach education and how we make it accessible to kids, right? What is it that you wish that teachers had known about you? You know, I think sometimes kids who struggle don't always feel like they have their voice in the classroom, despite a teacher's best efforts and goals in terms of creating a classroom of culture, you know, a classroom culture of belonging. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they feel a bit stifled, or they feel scared to really be, to stand within their authenticity, right? And so what is it that you wish your teachers had known about you when you were a kid?
I wanted to be included just as much as anybody else. I wanted to be part of the reading circle, even though I couldn't read it. I wanted to be part of the story mapping, even though I didn't necessarily understand all of the steps. I wanted to be able to write a story just like anybody else. That just because I struggled didn't mean I didn't want to be part of the class. When I went to school, and I admit this, when philosophies were different, you know, I do have, and they're vague memories, but I do have vague memories of being in a regular grade two classroom and sitting on my own while everybody else sat and read with the teacher, because I couldn't read the book that they were reading.
Mm.
And so, you know, the student might struggle to read it, but there's a different way than the student reading the book by themselves. Maybe the student gets to do a picture walk instead of reading the sentence. Maybe you know that that book is coming, and as the teacher, I mean, none of us have enough time. We know that. And I know that as a teacher, I can say there's never enough time.
Yes.
But, you know, if you know that you're going to sit with a class and read a particular story or a particular passage, give that kid the book the day before. Let them take it home. Practice it with them one recess for 5 minutes. Don't take their whole recess, because they need their recess. They need to run around. But take 5 minutes and say, hey, you know, we're going to read this book after recess. Would you be comfortable reading? Back to their voice, right?
Mm.
Give them the option. And we talked about this, you know, when we did tribes a few years ago, was, you know, you have the right to pass. So again, it's that same thing of providing them opportunity to be included, but also providing them with a safe space and a caring space to be able to say, I'm not comfortable doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives them voice, and it gives them power.
Yes. And so much of it, I think, you know, when there is that reluctance or sort of that pushback is often about power. It's often about feeling like I might fail and nobody can put me in this situation. And I mean, as an educator, I never want to be in that kind of a situation where I ever make a kid feel like they have to take a risk that they're not prepared to take. Because I just think that's such an unsafe place to be psychologically, right? I think when we're telling kids, you know, what they can and can't do despite their own inner sense, I think that can be really, really tricky. So yeah. What's really interesting about your journey, I think your take is so unique because not only have you experienced learning disabilities through the lens of, you know, dyslexia, but also as a mother now, you are experiencing it as a parent. And so as a mother of two children with ADHD and potentially some learning disabilities, as you said, you're sort of looking at that. Mm-hmm. How has your perspective changed even more and transformed? And then I think about how does that translate to the way that you interact as an educator with parents?
Wow, did it ever flip things for me? Mm-hmm. When I started working solely in the special education side of the school, I was not a parent. I was just a person who had an LD and thought, you know what? I get it. I know what these people are going through. Wow, did not get it. Did not even a little bit get it. Mm-hmm. And I gained a new understanding of what my parents must have gone through. And my mom and I talked about it many times, the sleepless nights, the stress, the we're never going to figure this out. They're never going to, you know, be able to do anything. Every time my phone would ring and it would see it was the school, I would just, you know, it was this emotional surge of, oh God, now what, right? Like another phone call. Mm-hmm. And so it changes the way I talk to parents about, their child's learning needs. It changes the tone of the conversation that I have with them, but it also changes how quickly I expect the parent to get on board with what we as the school want to do.
Right.
It allows me to sit back and say, okay, here is student X. Mom and dad are on .3 and we're on .10. Mm. We're going to get there, but it's going to take a lot of relationship building and trust building and understanding and just empathy on my part. It's not easy to have a child with any sort of challenge. It doesn't matter whether it's learning or otherwise. When you are pregnant with that child, when you know that that child is arriving as a father, as a mother, as a guardian, as whoever you are to that child, you have dreams for that kid. You, like it or not, we all do it. We all think, oh, this is going to be awesome. My kid is going to be amazing and they're going to be able to do this and that. And then school starts. And then it's like, oh, but wait a minute. Oh, shoot. No. But that's not how it's going to go.
Right.
And so having been that parent who had my dreams a little bit crushed,
sure,
I can kind of look at parents and say, it's okay. I get it.
Yeah.
I'm here when you're ready.
Right.
And I mean, sometimes, listen, there are times where, sure, as an educator, I have to work with my school psychologist and work with my school team in terms of really providing the information to the parents. You know, and that includes working with the psychologist, the social worker, the speech language pathologist, the special education consultant, that whole team, to support the parents in seeing and understanding kind of what are the strengths of their child, what are the things that they're amazing at. And these kids always have lots of them. Mm. But then looking at what are their needs? Where is it that they struggle? And how can they as the parent and us as the staff ensure success? Because at the end of the day, we want to make sure that every child is successful in whatever capacity they need to be able to do it in. And if that's using manipulatives and a calculator, or if that's using a computer to be able to do speech to text because, you know, handwriting is too hard. Those are all things that we can look at, and those are really basic. But, you know, helping the parents get there and just giving them time.
Mm-hmm.
I just think sometimes as teachers, we're so hurried to get to the outcome that we want that we forget that, you know, everybody just sometimes we just need to take a break. And these kids are sometimes not going to learn at the same pace as others. And that just needs to be okay. And it's not easy to say that. And it's hard. And I know it's hard because I'm living it right now. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it just takes time. My eldest is in grade 5. And when he was in grade 2, he was not reading. He was not writing. I wanted him to read and write and do all these amazing things. And I was pushing so hard. And I finally just said, okay, I'm going to let it go. He's now in grade 5, or grade 4, sorry. He's in grade 4. And he's reading and he's writing and he loves to read. And he gets lost in his books at night. Sometimes we have to go upstairs and say, buddy, like, it's 9 o'clock. You need to turn your light out.
That's so wonderful.
I never thought I would be able to say that. And I just had to give him space to figure it out. And I think as parents, we want our children to succeed so bad that we're willing to stand behind them and push them forward in any way. But sometimes that's not always helpful. And as teachers, we do the same thing, right? We think, yes, oh my goodness, this child is on level 5 and we need them to be at level 24 by the end of the school year. How are we going to do it? And then you start to push them. But then they lose the love of reading because the reason they're doing it isn't for them. They're doing it because you're telling them to, or because mom and dad are telling them to.
And I think underlying there is the message that there are not enough and that they need to achieve and get to this certain threshold to be enough. And I just think, oh, I loved your dots analogy. I just think that really resonates with me because you're right. Sometimes we are about 7 steps ahead of the parents and they're hearing this and processing this and all of the feelings of truly grief. Because I think, as you said, when you have a child, you do place some expectation on who they will be and what they will do, and despite your best efforts, right, to let them live their own lives. And I've experienced that even with my 4-year-old, you know, and it's different things, but it's so surprising, the journey of being a parent sometimes. And so allowing for that, making space for them. And also I hear a lot around from what you're saying about the need for patience for the parents to come to terms with it, patience for the child to get to that place on their own. And I think that really does come from a place of empathy and not needing to push anybody along for your own ends, but really to think about what is this experience for them and make that space for them. So I think those are really, really important points. Yeah.
It's hard. Patience is hard. And I can admit it. I am not good at patience. I am not a patient person. I have always been, put your head down and just do it. My middle kid he doesn't persevere. If he can't do it the first time, he just gives up and he almost refuses to try.
Sure.
And that drives me crazy because that is not who I am, but I have to allow him to be him, because if I don't allow him to be him, he will never figure it out.
Right.
And it's very hard as a parent to sit back and say, okay, this is your road to walk. You know, I'm going to hold his hand and I'm going to help him and I'm going to support him. But it's really hard sometimes to not get frustrated with the direction or the speed at which it's going.
Of course. And I think that's natural too. I also wonder, when it comes to the classroom supports, you mentioned a few things. Are there any practical tips that you might have for educators relating to the in-class supports and some of the things that we can do to make this space a happier, more welcoming space for kids who are struggling? I mean, for all of our kids, but generally for those kids who are struggling with any level of learning that we do in the classroom.
It's such a hard question to answer because I'm thinking of the kids at my school, and my job now in the way that the school board is going that I work for, they're going into an inclusive model. So all students are now integrated into the classrooms, which is great, gives lots of variety, and it allows children to see others struggle, which I think has a very big benefit. I would say at the end of the day, the biggest thing that I find teachers struggle with is understanding what it is that the student struggles with. If you are lucky enough to have that child in your room who has had, for example, a psychoeducational assessment done or a speech and language assessment done, those reports are your best friends. Mm. They will give you here are the things to do. Provide them with a quiet corner that they can go to. Have headphones, you know, noise-canceling headphones that they can put on if they're easily distracted. Maybe they're not going to be reading at level 24 by the end of grade 1. They might still only be on level 10, and that's okay. But making sure that you have books and material that is at the level that that child can succeed at. If you constantly have books and materials and things in the classroom that are too far advanced for that student, they are not going to feel successful. And therefore, they're not going to want to put in the effort because it's too much work. It's exhausting being a kid. Like, I'm exhausted as an adult, but when I look at these kids in our classrooms and I think they're living a life outside of our building that I don't know anything about,
right,
but can have its own stresses and its own issues, they're then coming into our building and maybe they're tired, maybe they're overactive, but they're overactive because they're overly tired, because there's something else happening. Provide them with a warm, safe environment where they feel like they can say, you know what, there's a book over there I know I can read, and there's a quiet corner over there that I know I can sit at. Also, don't expect kids to sit down in desks. There's a great YouTube video about basically like things I wish my teacher would know. And it basically goes through like, you know, I can't sit in a chair. Let me move. You know, don't take away my recess. Those sorts of things that kids, you know, or I think differently than other kids, or those sorts of things. And it's such a, it's a black and white video. It makes me as a teacher think about every kid I've ever taught and think, okay, when I was telling so-and-so to hurry up and sit down, what message did that send, right? That sent a message of, you're not doing what I'm asking you to. So make sure that the resources within the classroom are at a level in which the student can achieve and feel successful at. Provide them differing seating arrangements. These desks and chair things, we're moving so far away from those, and I think it's great. I think kids need to have the option. And then, you know, set them up sometimes in a group of kids who maybe think a little differently than them. If that means that they're higher achieving than that student, that's not a bad thing. Don't always put those kids in the lowest group.
Right.
Sometimes allowing them to try and achieve and think with other thinkers who maybe think on a different vibration than them can be really empowering because it allows them to see how others think.
And carry them along with them as well, right?
Right, which is fine because that's collaboration, right? You're collaborating with your group to come to a successful outcome. Maybe that person in the group who is a struggling learner could do the drawing of the story once the story is done. You know, if you're doing a group presentation thing or something, right? Like, there's lots of ways to do it. You have to be willing to be creative. And as a teacher, you have to know it's going to take time. And as a parent, you know, advocate for your child and say, you know, they brought this home or they came home crying about this or that. You know, it's really about the communication between the teacher and the parent. And the parent to not be afraid to ask questions. I find sometimes parents are, well, I don't want to bother you, or I don't want to, you know, I'm afraid to ask the question. Please ask. We're here to support you and your children. And if you don't tell us what's going on, we sometimes find it difficult because if something's happening at home, that can kind of set your kid off for a bad little rocky start, right?
Absolutely.
If we know something's going on, then we can be a little bit more empathetic and kind, and maybe, you know, kind of say, oh, well, you know, it's been a rough few days. We'll leave it at that and then start fresh the next day.
The communication piece is huge for sure. Can you tell me a little bit about Access to Education and the work that you do?
So really the goal of Access to Education is to allow parents to communicate with an individual, so at the moment me, who can help them navigate what is a really overwhelming systems of hoops to get the support that they need for their students. So whether that's, you know, they need help in understanding what the IEP means, they're reading through it and they're thinking, well, what does, you know, an accommodation mean? And what is the modification? And why are they modified and not accommodated? Those are questions sometimes that are difficult. And they're difficult as teachers. I've certainly done a lot of workshops for teachers with IEPs and even for us to understand the difference between an accommodation and a modification is complicated. So as a parent, when it's language you're not used to hearing, I can only imagine how difficult and overwhelming that is. But also, you know, if you're in a situation where you don't know kind of, do we do an assessment? Do we not do an assessment? Who do we need to see? Where do we start? You know, what part of the, how do we jump off? Where do we start from? We know there's something wrong, but we're not sure what to do. So I've certainly helped some parents with that, the starting off point in the IEPs. And most recently, I supported a family who had a child who had been in a special program and was returning into the regular program through IPRC. And the parent just needed guidance in terms of, what can I ask for in that meeting? You know, what is it going to look like? I've never been to one before. I don't know who's going to be in the room. How do I, you know, what do I say? What can I say? Is there something I can't say? Mm-hmm. And kind of trying to kind of lift the veil a little bit in terms of what all of this is. It's very scary. It's very overwhelming. The other thing I'm trying really hard to do on the access to education is provide resources as best I can, because there's lots of them out there. But ones that I have found helpful, that can maybe be found in one place. When I was going through this initially with my first son, one would think, you know, personally being affected by it, it wouldn't be so hard to find the resources. But I found it really daunting. There's hundreds of web pages and lots of stuff to read through, and what's good and what's not good. And so I'm trying to kind of narrow the focus a little bit for parents, so that they can kind of go to one website and say, oh, there's a Learning Disability Association. I'm going to start right there. And then that might lead them into other things, and that's fine. But if at least you can kind of get the big pieces kind of in one spot. And then as you kind of filter through and figure out what road you're taking, because everybody has a different road and a different story, then hopefully it can help you figure out what parts you need. And the blog is really just, at the moment, it's really going to be a focus around what I'm doing with my middle son. So last night's post was about the first meeting with the psychologist and what that looked like and what it felt like and the things we talked about. And then what comes next. And I'll continue to kind of update that blog as we go through, so parents can kind of follow the journey.
What you're providing there is some solidarity for people who are going through the exact same thing. And we know that when we feel like we're going through it alone, and I think there's a lot of feeling, you know, you can really feel elements of shame. It's really nothing to be ashamed about. And I think the ability to document those feelings and put it out there makes people feel less alone in their own journey, right?
For me, it's not even a shame thing, because I'm so far past the shame bit, because I'm out there. I've always told people, look, I have an LD. Like when I worked at a golf course one summer, and I said, do not put me on the ninth tee, because I cannot make change in my head. I don't have a calculator out there. I don't have a cash register. I will make errors every time. So they were like, okay, we're good. We got that. They kept me in the clubhouse, right? Because it worked for me. But I had to advocate for myself and say, listen, if you want me to work for you, I'm all for it, but this is not where you want to put me. But what it is for me, and this is a very personal thing, and it will be different for everybody, but for me, it's guilt. Mm. It's guilt about the fact that I have this, and there was a 50-50 chance that my kids would get it. I got 1 out of 3 has got it right now. So we're not batting very well at the moment, but it was really, I remember with my eldest, when we had it kind of officially done, where I really came home and I said to my husband, it's my fault.
Aww.
And he just sort of said, but it's not. It just is. You didn't get pregnant and say, I want him to be. But I remember having conversations with my husband when we were pregnant with our first. And I said, if I get even an inkling that there is anything wrong, I'm not waiting.
Right.
I'm not waiting. I'm not waiting till grade 3. I'm not putting him on a list at school. I am lucky in that I've been able to do everything privately.
Right.
Not everybody has that opportunity. And I think that is the biggest hurdle for many parents, is the wait lists at schools and other places are long and the waiting is agony. I just, you know, it was the guilt. It was having to let go of that and say, it's not my fault. I didn't do it. It's just the way his brain developed and I didn't pick it. It yeah. just did. So that took a long time. And I would say to any parent who feels that they did something for their child to be this way, is completely unfair and not giving them enough credit, because if they are realizing that there's something up, that's a big, huge step forward. And that in and of itself is hard to come to. And if you can get to that point, then you're on the right road.
Wow, that's powerful. That's really powerful. It's just very vulnerable. And I think it's universal as well, that element, especially if some of these difficulties run in the family, that can be a really legitimate element of this whole journey. And the private versus the public wait lists is certainly an element that we come up against time and time again, where the private is not an option. And so they're waiting. And I think there's an element of definite frustration and panic. And so I think having some of these alternative resources, like your, like access to education, is helpful, because at least there's the solidarity, and at least there's a list of resources that people can turn to in the meantime until they do get seen. But it is really tricky.
Well, that's what I hope. I mean, I really hope that people can see that it's, you know, there, and there are, I mean, I'm not the only one out there that's doing this. There are different ones, but everyone is geared a little differently. And mine is really just geared towards kind of trying to put it in one place, trying to be a place to ask questions in a way that is non-judgmental, in a way that is safe, open, accepting. And I just want to help, because it's scary and it's overwhelming. And I've been there and I've done it. As the child, I've done it, I've been there, but as the parent, I've been there, and I can absolutely empathize with every feeling, and the feelings are valid and the feelings are real, and they need to be accepted. And sometimes you just need to let it sit, and it's okay to let that anger, that guilt, or that sadness, just, you have to let it be and then move forward when you're ready. But nobody can force you forward, and nobody should make you forward. But you need to remember, as a parent or as a guardian or whoever you are to this child, that if you stay stuck, your child is stuck too. So you have to move through this journey together. And it's not an easy journey. And it can be very long and it can be very daunting, but it is so worth it at the end. The outcomes for these kids, when we get the answers and we put the power in their hands, is unreal. The potential is always unreal.
Powerful way to end. Before we move on to the three rapid fire questions, do you have anything else that you would like to add?
You know, I hope that parents who are listening to this, or teachers who are listening to this, know that, you know, as a teacher, even reaching out to someone who maybe knows about it a bit more, you know, reaching out to an advocate as a teacher, or asking questions as a teacher or as a parent. There are no silly questions. There are no questions that should not be answered. If you have a question and you need an answer, it's important to get the answer so that you can support either the student or the child or the parent themselves, depending on the situation.
What does kindness mean to you?
It means acceptance, and understanding, and allowing people to be who they are.
What trait or superpower should an educator lead with in order to be effective?
Love, for sure. Especially with these kids. Some of them need it more than others.
Yeah. And if you were to print one quote or message onto one of those cups sold in big book stores, what would it be?
Knowledge is power. Having the knowledge to know what your learning strengths are and what your learning needs are, allows you to be powerful and to be able to be your own superhero and go to people and say, I learn like this, and this is what I need. And for parents, that power is knowing who your child is and being able to advocate them and accept them. So knowledge is power.
Where can people find you, Delphine?
So at access2education.com is my website, but I'm also on Facebook and Instagram, and I try to keep those up to date.
Awesome. That's so great. This was a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining me on Kindsight. This was really, really informative and inspiring too.
Well, thanks. It was a really great conversation. I really enjoyed it.
I want to thank you for the wonderful reviews that you've left for this podcast on iTunes. Your reviews make a big difference in helping other educators find this show. If you think that I'm doing good work here and you'd like others to get inspired and join our 21-day kindness challenge and movement, I'd love it if you would take a minute, head over to iTunes, and leave a review. Thank you so much. This has been another episode of Kindsight 101, the podcast. For links to resources mentioned in this episode, visit smallactbigimpact.com and click on our podcast and choose this episode number. Now, I'd love to give my audience a heads up about my new book, which will provide ideas, actionable strategies, and inquiry-based approaches to creating a kinder classroom through serving the community. Subscribe to my blog for more information. Now, I would love to hear from you. What's the biggest insight that you gained from this conversation? Head over to our website, smallactbigimpact.com, leave a comment on our podcast page, or tag and connect with us on social media with the hashtag #SmallActBigImpact to share your inspiring story of kindness. Can't wait to hear from you.